Justin Kaufman here until 11 o'clock. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Nick, I think Nick's in tonight. He's back. Nick DiGilio will be back in studio tonight. We'll have him on the program. 312-981-7200. Nick's going to come on at some point soon to defend his favorite movie of all time, Risky Business. That's going to be fun. That'll be coming up. All right. Chris Jones is here, the chief theater critic over at the Chicago Tribune and also the author of Rise Up, Broadway and American Society from Angels in America to Hamilton. And the reason you're here to talk about the final show last night, Hamilton,
yes,
in Chicago. Good to see you, buddy. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Happy New Year to you.
So before we get into what's going to replace Hamilton and what to look forward
nothing,
to in 2020,
nothing.
This what a phenomenon. Obviously,
yeah,
a phenomenon on Broadway, and everyone knows that. But you know, there was a thought when Hamilton came to Chicago and it was sold out and sold out and sold out and sold out, that it would be like, you know, I don't know, Book of Mormon and other shows that have
right.
done the same thing,
right.
and it would run out of gas. It didn't.
It has been a phenomenon. It has grossed $400. I just count these dollars. This is close to your salary. $400 million.
Jeez, wow.
And that's in Chicago alone. If you just put your head around that kind of money, and it is pretty much sold out every seat
for theater.
For theater in Chicago, not in New York where they have more money than sense. In Chicago, where people, you know, it is hard to get a Chicagoan to drop $350, $400. And every day I get an email from some grumpy Tribune reader going, "Why is this $400? It's ridiculous." But so there's, you know, they've had to fight that Midwestern frugality,
yeah,
shall
right,
we say.
Right.
And they've done it with huge success. And, you know, Sunday afternoon, it was a matinee show yesterday, and it was, everyone in there was kind of a super fan, you know. Laurie Lightfoot's there. She comes up to me. She says, "I've seen it 5 times.
Wow.
I'm like, really?
That says a lot.
Really,
that says something about the mayor, doesn't it?
I was like, really, mayor? And it didn't, you know, I thought you were a Bears fan predominantly. Didn't know you were going 5 times
five
to the
times.
Local
yeah,
musical.
Right?
And it was that kind of atmosphere. It was a really, really good time. And then the other sort of story there that's been really amazing is the guy playing Hamilton, Miguel Cervantes is his name. Great guy. Lovely, lovely, lovely guy. And, you know, a lot of people in Chicago are familiar with the story of his family, mm-hmm. how he lost his
terrible, yeah.
daughter, you know, who suffered from epilepsy, very, very early age epilepsy, and how he became a kind of a spokesperson for that. I think he was, you know, all over the media talking about those things. And he did that role for 3.5 years. Now, most of the time, as you know, Justin, you know, actors stick around for a year or so, and then they go somewhere,
yeah.
you know, drive you crazy.
Even Broadway, yeah.
Even Broadway. Yeah, it's right, usually, right. It's really a phenomenon for him to have done that show for its entire run. And the thing is that no one knew who he was when he came here. His guy from New Jersey. He was actually about to quit the business and become, I think, a wrestling coach. He's a big sports guy. He likes golf. He's that kind of guy. And he got a gig in Chicago. No one knew who he was. He leaves here a real celebrity that Chicago created.
And he does. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Because I would have thought at the beginning, I'm like, oh, Lin-Manuel's not coming here?
Right.
Who are these guys? Who's going to be the next guy? And you're right. He is now a household name in Chicago.
Right. If I asked you who's playing the role right now on Broadway, what do you know?
No.
No. You know what? Neither do I. And I'm his theater critic. And it's like, he is, you know, he's become a star. And so, you know, I was sort of sitting on this news for the last couple of weeks. I knew he was going to take over the role on Broadway. And I'm thinking, you know what? I'll just roll that out as a capper right at the end of Hamilton. So, so that's the news. He's moving, you know, he's moving to New York and he's playing Hamilton on
so
Broadway.
So he's just moving right out of this production into the Broadway production.
Yeah,
of
the
Hamilton.
flagship production of the most important
Congratulations
show.
Congratulations to him.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
And no nicer guy. And I really mean that. He is really a really sweet guy. I'm very unpretentious. Lives in Bucktown. Got a nice little house in Bucktown. Lovely little family. He's going to chill here, I think, for a few weeks before he goes.
Yeah.
But it that was a sort of a part of it. And it's funny. I've been at a lot of closings, and they're always very emotional because theater creates these instant families, and people don't like to leave each other. And Miguel, on Sunday, if you've been there, he really didn't want to leave that stage. They almost had to drag him off. He's smiling away. He couldn't, you know, he just couldn't get it. He just couldn't get enough of that moment. And, you know, it was really sort of something. And there's the mayor up there, like, geeking out over. She's, like, going on about, oh, you know, I'm singing in my shower. I'm not going to miss my shot and all that. And it was just a very, very emotional thing. And for me, you know, let me talk about me for a second. I've had this great ride with this show as a critic because my bosses, who don't give a darn about the theater a lot of the time, with all due respect, arts are a struggle in the Midwest. Are they not, Justin? They're a struggle.
We'd rather watch
the Bulls and the Bears, would we not? We'd rather click on those stories. But Hamilton, whole other thing. Front page, everybody gets it. Stories do really well. Great, you know, it's been a sort of a great ride for me because the show, I've never had to make the case for this show because everybody knows what I'm talking about. Like right now, here we are talking about a show. If we're talking about any other show, all of your listeners would be like, why are they spending all this time on this show? Hamilton, you never have to make that case. It is a unique thing. And people say to me, what's the other show like this? And I go, none. There is none. It's just sort of incredible.
I saw the show this summer for the first time.
Wow.
And, you know, I was amazed at how I knew all the songs already.
Right.
You know, I really was. And I'm not a guy who had my son wasn't into the soundtrack. It wasn't like, it was pounding in every time we put the radio on. But it's just because these songs became part of pop culture. They became the Not Gonna Miss My Shot or the Immigrants, We Get the Job Done, or all the different little parts of these songs that were performed at different points have seeped into popular culture in a way that I have not seen. You know, you see, I mean, Cats is a good example of songs that, you know, that you might remember, but not like this.
No, I don't think any theater score has ever done that in the last, you know, 30 or 40 years. There was a time, as you well know, in the 40s and the 50s when theater scores actually created top 10 hits fairly routinely. And many of the so-called American songbook standards are actually from shows. But that sort of went away. I always think that really went away in the era of the Beatles, which really popularized the idea that artists write their own songs. So once you had the Beatles and writing their own songs, the idea of pulling standards from shows sort of went away. And this musical has absolutely done that. It's really something. I was sort of melancholy. As you said, you know, I wrote this book about The Road to Hamilton, Rise Up, it's called, if you want to buy it on Amazon. And it, in it, I sort of said, this show really became synonymous with the Obama administration because it was developed at the White House in part. Obama was promoting it on the Tony Awards back in, I think, 2016. It was very, very synonymous with what Obama wanted to say about America. And what I mean by that is it represented diversity and unity. And it's not confrontational in the way that the left and the right are now. It's very tolerant. And it's very much about mortality. It's about parenting. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's about work-life balance. You know, take a break. Go, don't work all the time, right. Justin. It's for you. And it was very much that world. And we are now in a really, really different place. And I don't mean that to be a partisan statement. I just mean both sides of the political discourse are in a completely different
because
place.
Because the story of Hamilton and the story that's in the play, you do have other, you have, you know, you have the protagonist, you have the anti, you have Jefferson, and he doesn't see the same as Hamilton. All the things that are in politics today are in this play, but they're not as divisive as the way it plays out in the current.
Precisely correct. And it embraces complex thinking. It says that everything is nuanced, the political ideas are nuanced, everybody's got flailings and flaws, and that's just how it is. And it sort of points out that the founding fathers were these young, energetic, scrappy guys who were some of them in their 20s at the time. And it had this brilliant idea of if we make it look like the America of today, people will get excited about it. And it was just a kind of a brilliant idea. And I was sitting there going, wow, this will, you wouldn't write this now. And then I started thinking to myself, that's a really strange thing to, it's only been, what, 5 years, 6 years, but America's changed that much in 5 or 6 years. And there's something about the openness of Hamilton and the idea that a Republican can enjoy it and a Democrat can enjoy it, and that there's a belief in the possibility of America, the idea that we can all, you know, that the country and democracy has failings, but ultimately it's on a good trajectory.
Yeah, it's country
and
over just, party.
Yeah, country right. over party, country right. over, yeah. And it just, there's something about it that everyone can kind of agree on, and it's not angry, you know, and it's, and I'm sitting there going, wow. This is over now. And I'm like, you couldn't write this now. And I'm like, what the heck happened? What happened?
The book is called Rise Up, Broadway and American Society, From Angels in America to Hamilton. Chris Jones, the chief critic over at the Chicago Tribune. Let's take a break, come back, we'll continue the conversation. Hamilton closed in Chicago yesterday, and we're sad. It's WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. Chris Jones is here, the chief theater critic over at the Chicago Tribune, and the author of Rise Up. You know, I had this moment where I've really, I don't know, they've kind of, in my family, I've been pigeonholed as the Revolutionary War guy, right?
Yeah.
I really liked it when I was a kid. I liked all the stuff about it. And I've been waiting and waiting for my son to get to the point where he might get that lesson and find that spark, and we'll go to Boston and go check out where Bunker Hill and
throw some tea in the water and stuff.
Yeah. That passion has been replaced by this play, by Hamilton, meaning he gets more out of the story of the American Revolution and the beginning of this country from Lin-Manuel Miranda than he does from his eighth grade or seventh grade teacher. And I wonder if that's the power of art in this scenario, that so many young people probably disconnected themselves from that story because it's, you know, what I got to do, my homework and all this kind of stuff, and weren't paying attention to it. And this play has ignited interest in the story of the beginning of this country.
I think, you know, you can blame the money in your wallet, right, for this view of the Founding Fathers as these old dudes. And I think the brilliance of Hamilton was that it figured out that if you could actually make the Founding Fathers young, scrappy, and hungry as they were, and if you could make them not all white, that you could say, okay, if we have African Americans playing this role, actors of color playing these roles, that in itself will make a statement that this was the beginning of an America for everybody. And that's the brilliance of the show. And it wasn't like, oh, you know, 3 years from now, we'll cast a black guy. That wasn't what it was. It's right in the DNA of the show, just as it's in the DNA of America as a nation of immigrants. And that's what it did. And it did it sort of brilliantly. And it also, it came up with the idea, you know, the idea of anachronism. So the funny thing is, you can have Jefferson in the show going, "What's up?" Or you can have them rapping or any of those things. And audiences accept it. Now, you might think, if you're listening to this on the radio, you've never seen the show, that must be really weird to see these Founding Fathers doing, you know, very contemporary idiom. But in fact, if you believe in the truth of the story, then you go along with it. And that's a sort of an amazing thing. The other thing, Justin, I think, is that in Alexander Hamilton's story was a couple of unique things. One was, he was massively successful, and then he makes this terrible mistake. This is the real guy, where he has an affair. And in the end, it's presented in the musical quite, you know, as a sort of a favorable thing. But I mean, obviously, it wasn't ideal. He has an affair, and then he pays off the woman he was sleeping with, her husband. He pays him off, and that ultimately ends his chances at the presidency. And so it's an almost Clintonian kind of turn. So there's that. But the thing that's more significant is that he lost his child. So in Act Two of Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton loses his kid Philip, and the kid dies in a duel that he's fighting because he's defending his father, using the tactics that his father has given him. So the worst possible thing for a dad, as you well know, A, is of course to lose your son or your child, any child. And then even more awful is to lose them because they're trying to be like you, or they're doing something that you told them to do. Yeah. It is the worst thing. And this show sort of contains it. And so therefore, what the musical can say in Act Two then is that ultimately you can write one of the greatest documents ever written in the history of human democracy. You can do all that, but you would still take it all back if you could have another hour or two with your kid. Even if you are a founding, in other words, we love so much and we love our kids so much that to lose them is so unspeakably terrible that it cancels out all our other achievements, right?
It's those complexities that make this musical the best that there ever was.
Yeah,
and because a lot of times in musicals, you get to the second act and it's now just about love and the love story and maybe a breakup and then they get back together, whatever it might be, but you simplify these storylines. And in Hamilton, it gets complex. And I mean, just what you just described is like no other when it comes to stagecraft. Those are very complex moments.
Well, we're all struggling in our lives, I think. We're all struggling with certain, we have certain common struggles that we all have. One of them is how much do we work? Like, you know, how hard do we work? How motivated should we be? Like, the show is also about this. It's the idea that Hamilton is this insanely motivated guy. Other characters come up to him and say, "Why you're always writing like you're running out of time?" And he's like, "Well, I am running out of time." And so you watch that and you go, "Huh, how much time do I have left?" We all have a really limited time. And so sometimes those of us who are not that successful, we think to ourselves, "Wow, really successful people get that in a way I don't. They work harder because they know they're running out of time." But then on the other hand, you run out of time and then you die. And you're like, okay, then what happens? Well, you may have a good reputation.
Right.
We may remember Justin fondly,
right.
Or we may not. And and you actually
may get on the $10 bill.
You may not.
Right.
And actually, you can't control that.
Right.
And so there's just as good an argument that actually, rather than leave your kids to get that promotion for the, you know, doing 40 billable hours on a Saturday and a Sunday, there's an argument instead that you should actually be with the people you love, because ultimately, at the end of the end of life, which will matter more? And that is true even at the really highest levels of achievement, human achievement. And all of this is in that musical. So it becomes so relatable in a way that we often don't think of presidential politics or even politics as being relatable. And my suspicion was the mayor, Mayor Lightfoot, sees a lot of that. You know, she was there with her partner, Amy, and her kid, and I was thinking, you know, I bet this family is really sort of on board with all of these issues. Mm-hmm. You know, if anyone who's married to a very successful person or a very hard-driving person often says to them at some point, you know, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
You're never satisfied, which is what everyone says to Hamilton. You'll never be satisfied. And he goes, well, you know, I can't help it. But so, in other words, what I'm saying, Justin, I guess, is these are issues that are really
It's well said.
You know, ubiquitous. We all think about them.
No, it's so great. I mean, I just thought it was a hip hop musical. So, Rise Up is the book, Broadway and American Society, from Angels in America to Hamilton. Chris Jones is the author and also the chief theater critic at the Chicago Tribune. Let's take a break here. We'll come back, and I want to find out what's next for Hamilton. What's next for Chicago Theater? Because before Hamilton, it was like they needed a Hamilton.
Yeah.
And they got it. So what's next? Much to talk about here as we look forward as Hamilton ends in Chicago. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Stay with us. 720 WGN here in Chicago. Justin Kaufman with you. Chris Jones is here, the chief theater critic for the Chicago Tribune. We're talking about the final Hamilton performance, which was last night. At the Schubert. I can't call it what it's called now.
Whatever. Some bank. it's always
it's
the
Sunbank Theater.
Schubert to me, baby.
Yeah. So anyway, the end of Hamilton in Chicago. Where does it go now? Does it? Because you've told us this before. It goes on to another theater.
Yeah,
another
LA.
City.
I think.
It's
I
LA?
Mean, basically LA. But that company will sort of become a tour now, really. Right. So that's what they're going to.
Will we see Hamilton again in Chicago?
Absolutely, you will. It makes too much money, my friend, to not come back. But it's there will be, I think, a respectful break. So I would anticipate, my guess is 2 to 3 years, and then it'll come back, but not with Miguel.
Well, that will be the test of this musical, right? I mean, if it becomes the kind of thing that just every year, every Christmas time, it's back in Chicago.
Well, is it? Yeah,
we'll get sick of it.
It's interesting to me. Some people have asked me, like, why did it close if it was making money? And so let's do a little math. You know, that show, to run that show, probably costs about $500,000 a week, maybe $700,000. It's been making $2 million a week. So, you know, it's been making a very nice profit. Now, if it was making, let's say, $1.5 million a week instead of two, it would still be making a big profit. But so they could have run it another year, maybe another 2 years at that 1.5 level. Why did they not do that? I think the answer to that question lies in the fact that they don't want to affect the sort of the prestige of the brand, if you like. You know, it's a bit like, you know, Louis Vuitton. You don't discount, you burn it. You know what I mean? You don't put the ticket, right, you don't put that stuff on. It's not Bed Bath and Beyond, you know? You don't do that because you realize that you lose more money once the exclusivity is gone. And I think that's the philosophy behind Hamilton. They didn't want there to be empty seats. So there, and they didn't want to have it on the half price discount, you know, advertising here on the Justin Kaufman show. Didn't want to do any of that. They just wanted
right up.
They just you know, here's the discount code for my listeners. They didn't want to do any of that, and so that's why they left. And I think people find that a little strange, but it's smart.
The Broadway scene in general after Hamilton has had some hits and successes. It always does, but nothing at the grand scale that Hamilton. That has a trickle-down effect, meaning that everything that comes to the Midwest or comes to the West Coast, the same shows. So there's nothing like Hamilton on the horizon.
I don't think there is. There's nothing I've seen that's like Hamilton. I mean, there's some good shows this year. I mean, we've got a big revival of West Side Story on Broadway coming. We've got Six, which has already been in Chicago, which is a lot of fun. We've got Mrs. Doubtfire, which there's a lot of good buzz about based on that. Sing Street, which is another kind of the music of Duran Duran. I'm a big Duran Duran fan. I'm looking forward to that.
You're a big Duran Duran fan?
I am, yeah.
Like, what are we talking, like Wild Boys?
Oh, I love it,
Boys. Now I've got you, like, hanging, dancing around in my head.
Okay. Yeah, no, I'm into all that music. Okay. And so there's good shows, but there's nothing at this level.
Right.
And that's not unusual. Shows at this level pop up about once every decade.
So coming up here, I mean, because we've got Phantom of the Opera's here. There's Mean Girls coming up soon, if it's not already
started. It's already here.
So, I mean, do they fill the downtown theater gap? Does Broadway Chicago? No. But that's, I mean, that's... What do they do? Do you, as a business model, do you do more of these kind of shows? Do you do limited runs? What do you do to try and capture that theater going audience?
The big money is in the long running shows. That's where the big money is, because you're able to sell groups and people can plan for it. And they just do so much more business. A lot of the shows that come here don't do anything like the business of the big long-running shows. So they've got to find the next one. The most promising one in the immediate future is Moulin Rouge, which is going to be here next year, later this year now. It's 2020. So that will be – that's promising. That's a good time. It's not Hamilton. I mean, it's Moulin Rouge. It's the same as a movie. It's clips of songs, you know, Katy Perry, Baby You're a Firework, whatever. It's not, you know, it's not on the same level, Justin. However, it's a good time and there's nothing wrong with it. You know, they had a rough time. They were trying to do the Michael Jackson show here.
Right.
That, you know, that hit, shall we say, some bumps in the road.
Now, that's a good example of, because we have seen nonstop talk about the, you mentioned the Duran Duran show, or even the way they do with movies like Mrs. Doubtfire, Moulin Rouge.
Yeah.
But those kind of shows, those jukebox type musicals. I was thinking the Britney Spears one.
Right, that's coming. Yeah. Still. Mm-hmm.
Do they have the ability to get the hooks in an audience like Hamilton does? I mean, well, let's take the Michael Jackson one out of contention. They messed that up. He messed that up.
Yes.
But somewhat, you get a big, I don't know what it might be, a Beatles show or a U2 show or something like that. Are those the kind of things that they sell like long term? Will they give Chicago the kind of thing they need?
I think, you know, those shows are interesting. So the idea of the jukebox show is that you take a catalog by a particular artist, usually, mm-hmm. and then you build a show around it. Often it's a biography of the artist. The best one at the moment is the Tina Turner show, which is on Broadway. There's also there was one done with Donna Summer that's coming to Chicago, actually in just a few weeks, which is pretty terrible.
What's it called?
The Donna Summer musical.
Oh, come on. They missed the golden opportunity. You could do, what does she do? She does Bad Girls.
Last Chance for Love.
I should say Bad Girls, the Donna Summer story. Like this, I don't know, man. They come to me for some of these titling.
Whenever I talk about Last Dance, I have this flashback to when I was a teenager and you'd be at a disco. And it would be a slow dance, and you'd be your last chance to get off with whatever girl you were hoping, in my case, to get off with. And it'd be like, last chance for love. And you'd be like, okay, this is great. And then in the middle, it gets really up to it. Yeah. And she would leave you, in my case. You'd go away.
That's when the roller skating happened.
That's right.
So you had to get the roller skates on real quick for that. Anyway.
Speaking of which, one of the new shows coming to Chicago is called, terrible title, actually, Hit Her With the Skates. And it's coming to the Royal George this spring, and it's about a roller rink. It's based on a roller rink in the Chicago area. So that's interesting. The biggest show coming, I think, the show that I'm most looking forward to is Bug, which is a Tracy Letts. You know, he's everywhere, man.
He is.
He's a big star. Now
they're putting... of course. But I love this story because Bug has already been in Chicago. Tracy did this show. I remember this in the 90s or whatever. And it was always compared to August Osage County or whatever the other Tracy Letts shows as kind of like his secondary show.
Yes.
Now that he's become so popular and he's the guy, is this like people, it's almost like they don't know about this show and he's going to have total success with this thing.
Well, it's, you know, and people can't get enough of him. There's actually two Tracy Letts plays on Broadway this season. Linda Vista, which was at Steppenwolf already, and The Minutes, which was at Steppenwolf already. And they've juiced that up for Broadway with, you know, extra stars. So that is going to be a thing. Like, now, The Minutes is going
to
be a big thing.
Can I ask you a question on this before we move on to the Bug?
Yeah.
When they do that, is it still a Steppenwolf production? Do they bounce Steppenwolf out? Like, if it's at Steppenwolf, does Steppenwolf have any credit when it goes to Broadway?
They get a royalty. I mean, it's not their production anymore because they don't actually want, you know, they really don't want to risk the money. They've got a new building they're trying to build. I mean, I think they got really burned, interestingly enough, with Ladysmith Black Mambazo. They actually did one of their early collaborations with them. They actually produced it themselves on Broadway. They lost a lot of money. Mm. So generally what happens with a theater like Steppenwolf is that a commercial producer comes in,
buys it,
and then they pay Steppenwolf a royalty. Mm. And of course they're hiring those actors and performers.
That's fascinating when it comes to Broadway business. I wouldn't, because you always think about that when you see that show in Chicago and then you see it on Broadway winning Tonys and you're like, why is the Chicago guys not up there?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's why,
So you look at the dude, Tracy Letts. So he's got two plays on Broadway, right? He's cropping up in like Little Women, you know, a lot of people think is the best film of the year, right? He's on TV. It's just dazzling to me. And Bug, which I remember being done at a Red Orchid Theater with, you know, Mike Shannon in the same pair of dirty Y fronts that he used to do every play in back then. Mike Shannon, you know, used to live in the box office at Red Orchid. He lived in the box office. You'd call down there. I always remember calling there at 3 a.m. one time because I woke up. It was before the internet's. And I was like, oh, what's tomorrow? Oh, I've got to see a show at Red Orchid.
I'll call and see what the curtain time is.
And this voice goes,
hello.
It's like Mike Shannon. Anyway, so Mike Shannon was originally in it. He's not in this new production. But in this new production is Carrie Coon, a.k.a. Awesome. Mrs. Tracy Letts. Mm-hmm. Lives in Bucktown right here. another big star. She's gone from like
she's
0
Stacey
to 80.
Wife?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Because she was in The Leftovers.
Yes, she
on
was.
HBO. She
and
was
very good. She
fantastic
was.
Fantastic.
Fantastic actress.
Fantastic, yeah.
She is fantastic. And it's, you know, that's a real coup. And if that show is any good, that will go to the Broadway. Maybe, except how many Tracy Letts plays can the Broadway stand, Justin, in one season? I mean, plus the movies that he's in, plus television. This is this guy in his...
It's a great Chicago success story.
Incredible! Yeah, yeah. You know, it is a Chicago success story without parallel. It really is. And it all started with August Osage County. But it's just spiraled. It just, you know, and he's not a kid, right? He's in his 50s. He's not a user-friendly guy, particularly. He is who he is. He doesn't compromise. He's not, you know, he's not sycophantic. He's not, you know, giving interviews every 5 seconds.
Right.
At his age, and with that sort of personality that's very uncompromising, I don't know anyone else who's become... I'm just like, I just couldn't get over the fact there he is in Little Women. I mean, why not? Tracy Letts.
And he's also prolific in the way that he's able to, because he had success with August H. H. County, he's able to be available and prolific enough to write new plays or to just have a canon available. And that is the story for anyone who wants to be a playwright, who anyone who wants to be in Hollywood, is what's your next project? Are
yes,
you ready?
That's
and
right.
He is always ready with his next project.
That's right.
And I mean, that's what makes him successful.
No, that's right. You know, it's interesting. One of the shows, the great shows over Christmas, was this show at the Lyric Opera called The Light in the Piazza, which is a musical I really like. It's written by this guy called Adam Gettle, is his name. He is the grandson of Richard Rodgers, as in Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Wow.
Great, great guy. And a most fantastic. I'm there's no bigger fan of his than me. But the guy doesn't write very much. And you're like, okay, what was the next show after? Like, well, he's still writing it. And it's like... And when he writes it, they are brilliant.
Right.
And I don't mean, you know...
Some take more time than others.
Some people take more time than others, and some prolific people crank out, you know, stuff that's, you know, just cranked out. And he doesn't. And I respect that. But still, you're absolutely right. The machine needs product, especially now where you've got your Netflix, you've got all of these, you know, who can keep up with all the product that's out there now?
When you think of companies, ensembles like Steppenwolf, and you have the success that Tracy's had and others, they have invested in talent that is not just actors on stage. They have invested in producers. They've invested in playwrights, directors.
Yes.
That's what makes that strength of that ensemble so big, and why this company continues to do good work.
Yeah, and I think initially they were just actors. In those first few years, that's how they made their bones, so to speak. But they made, you're exactly right, they made this brilliant decision to expand that, to actually generate their own content. And that really is, see, if you think about it now, what's changed in the world is the appetite for content. In other words, that you don't really want to be an actor just doing the same somebody else's play. You really now want to be generating new work. There's a lack of tolerance now for older work. And if you look at TV, very rarely on TV do you watch a script that you've seen before. Mm. Almost every TV show is new.
If they're remaking a concept.
Correct. I mean, many of them are very similar in structure, but they are all new.
Yeah.
That's now where we've ended up, you know.
Thinking about watching, and it won the Golden Globe last night, Succession.
Yeah, I mean, I'm obsessed with Succession.
Yeah. And when you watch it, especially season two, I remember one of the episodes, I was like, this is Shakespearean, in the way that the plot and the family and the dynamic against each other and the conflict is so complex. It almost feels like a play. And that's the key. I mean, these guys are HBO writers that are writing TV as if it is a timeless play.
And many of them are actually playwrights. Like, you know, for example, Lucy Prebble, who wrote many of the Succession episodes, she wrote the play Enron. That was, I'm sure, how she got that gig. Yeah, you're right. I mean, Succession is basically one of the greatest myths in drama is the so-called old king, young king ritual. You know, the idea of an old king in the, you know, the Brian Cox character in Succession, and then a battle with the young kings. And really, it's all about where is the focus, you know, where is the focus of it? I keep thinking about writing a column about how in Succession, the beginning of Succession, that character has mental, you know, he has dementia. And boy, it just disappears when they're done with it, doesn't it?
They really
and I was just
it.
Thinking...
He got well.
He got well. And I was thinking, I was watching, I'm also a Downton Abbey fan, and at the end of the Downton Abbey TV show, the butler, Mr. Carlson, had these tremors. He had sort of Parkinson's. Beginning of the movie, gone.
Gone.
Completely.
So the stuff to watch for would be Bug.
Would be Bug for sure. I think Bug. I think Bug is absolutely, you know, the most anticipated show in my view of the year. There's another one though that I'm really looking forward to. It's called Her Honor Jane Byrne, and
yes.
It is this new play Looking Glass,
right. Yeah.
About Mayor Jane Byrne, and it's set in 1981, which I'm sure some listeners will well recall was the year in which Jane Byrne moved into Cabrini Green.
Yeah.
Now, if you think about how much this city has changed since Jane Byrne moved into Cabrini Green, that's kind of amazing. But it's there's not really been a play or a movie in any sort of prominence it's really about Jane Byrne.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of really curious about that. That's a brand new piece. I'm a sucker for Chicago history pieces. And it's written by J. Nicole Brooks, who's an interesting
rising
writer.
Rising star, yeah.
Young African-American mm-hmm. woman, very talented actress and writer. And I think that's going to be really interesting.
I do, too. I saw the placard when we were over there, and I was like, this looks great, man.
Yeah. That's
Jane Byrne, you
Jane
got me.
Yeah, no, totally cool. I think totally cool. And then the other one that's sort of edgy and interesting is a play called Row, which is opening at the Goodman in a couple of weeks, directed by Vanessa Starling.
It's the story of Row Khan, the afternoon show.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
And the other Row, of course, in the Row versus Wade abortion debate. And that is a play that some people find really balanced and fair, and that some people find infuriating.
Mm.
So that play,
I
think is going to be a good one. I'm sort of excited to see
that. All right. Chris Jones, the chief theater critic for the Chicago Tribune, telling us what to expect from the Chicago theater scene after, post-Hamilton.
In the malaise, post-Hamilton. The doldrums.
Happy New Year. Great to see you, man.
Great to see you, Justin. Thanks for having me.